Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Inquiries and Criminal Law Seminar. Thank you very much for taking the time to attend, either in person here today or via webinar. At the outset, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, on whose land we meet today. I pay my respects to the elders, past and present. It is their lands upon which this museum is built. Now, our presentations this afternoon are on the general topics of sentencing in the local court and coronial inquests. We chose these as general topics from the work that we do within our division, which each raise issues of community safety, and we thought that they would also hopefully be of interest across a number of agencies. Using a panel and hypothetical format, the presenters will explore a number of issues in these general topics, and they will also provide some key takeout points and tips. We'll also have a short period at the end of each session for some questions. Before I introduce the first set of panellists, if I could just ask people to please ensure that they have their mobile phones either switched off or on silent. Thank you. Now for the first presentation, I'd like to introduce our panellists for the topic of sentencing in the local court. They each work in the CSO Inquiries and Criminal Law Division and have extensive experience in prosecution and sentencing proceedings more specifically. Their bios are in the material provided with Special Counsel, Cameron Gardner, Solicitor Advocate, and Sophie Williams, also Solicitor Advocate. I hand over to you, Brett.
Thanks very much, Naomi, and good afternoon to everyone, and welcome. I can see quite a few familiar faces in the audience and hopefully out there in webinar land. I must say it's a little bit daunting starting the program this afternoon, because I can tell you that I'm assured that there's quite an extravaganza in store in terms of the inquiries presentation. So I feel a little bit like I'm opening for the Rolling Stones or something at the moment, but I'll do my best. When we gave consideration to a selection of seminar topics for today, the subject of sentencing really did suggest itself. This was for a number of reasons. First, I've been involved in a number of cases where clients in particular had raised issues about sentences that could be imposed in certain matters. Slide up there. And secondly, also, I've been approached by colleagues who had asked questions about what can or should or could be said by prosecutors in sentencing proceedings. So in dealing with those inquiries, it occurred to me that there is quite a lot that's not necessarily obvious about the manner in which prosecutors are able to present cases, and there's much that's obscure in terms of the sentence process itself, particularly for people in client agencies who may not necessarily always be involved in court. So the aim of this presentation is to explain some of the parameters that operate in the sentencing procedures, particularly from the point of view of prosecutors and also from the point of view of agencies who are responsible for investigating enforcing, is to explain some of the parameters that operate in the sentencing procedures, particularly from the point of view of prosecutors and also from the point of view of agencies who are responsible for investigating enforcing compliance activities in relation to matters that amount to sentencing proceedings, and hopefully to suggest some practical guidance. So in terms of sentencing in the local court, the majority of the matters which the Crown Solicitor becomes involved in the criminal team usually are in the local court. So much of this discussion is specific to that jurisdiction. However, some of the principles are quite general in their application. The first thing that I do when I'm thinking about sentencing, or indeed any form of advocacy, is to consider the position of the magistrate and to try to anticipate what the magistrate's reaction to my case will be, and to anticipate what matters I should be trying to address to maximise the presentation of my case, including on sentence. And I think one of the characteristics that all of us have as lawyers, acting for client agencies, and probably no doubt the same characteristics that various people have working in their own agencies, is that we naturally tend to focus on ourselves, our own role, or our own task, our own target, or KPI. But successfully appearing for a prosecutor before a magistrate requires us to step out of ourselves to some extent and to try to get into the mind of the magistrate. So in thinking about this task, I think it's instructive to have some regard to the context to understand the environment that we're operating in. The most recent by the New South Wales Local Court contains some fairly illuminating information and some sobering reminders, really, about just how challenging our task can be in attempting to efficiently present a matter in the local court. So in the foreword of the most recent annual report for the local court, the Chief Magistrate described the challenges facing the local court as being, quote, a burgeoning caseload, long sitting hours and a shortage of resources. And I'm sure anyone who's been in the local court recently would easily appreciate that. As at December 2018, there were approximately 137 magistrates sitting. That's probably changed slightly since then, but it would be generally correct. Local court sits in 150 different locations in New South Wales and sits on 34 different country circuits. In the year ending 2018, the local court finalised 338,807 criminal matters. The most recent information I could obtain suggests that about 20% of those are regulatory prosecutions. So just thinking about that and having that in mind, it doesn't take a lot of reflection to understand that magistrates on a daily basis are hearing and determining very high volumes of matters. Of course, those figures don't give you any feel for the detail, but a number of those matters are likely to be very serious criminal matters. So it's the likelihood that when the Crown Solicitor appears in a local court on any given day, there'll be a very limited window of opportunity in which to present the case that we're appearing in and to make an impact on the magistrate. So when we analyse the task in this way, it's easy to see why, you know, presenting materials and submissions to a magistrate, come to grips with legislation, any guiding principles, attempt to glean some knowledge of the circumstances and the background of the offender, be it an individual or a corporation, and then impose a sentence which is fair in accordance with the law. Now, I mentioned the issue of legislation in that summary, and the matters in which the Crown Solicitor appear are quite important in that respect. Regulatory offences often arise under a plethora of different pieces of legislation, some of which are likely to be fairly unfamiliar to the average sentencing magistrate. Many of the legislative schemes have objects that are specifically directed to achieving policy outcomes or enforcing compliance with particular regulatory systems. So some of these schemes can be quite complex and technical in nature, and many introduce novel and in some cases extended concepts of liability as well. So, for example, the National Heavy Vehicle Law, and I know Pete is here, that's something that Peter will be familiar with, contains quite specific requirements in relation to the operating requirements of heavy vehicles. The regulation under that law, which is the Heavy Vehicle Mass Dimension Loading National Regulation, runs to something like 85 pages and refers to such arcane topics as how to calculate the gross combination mass of a vehicle. And just for your assistance, I'll give you an idea of what that formula is. And as you can see there, it's a reasonably involved formula and refers to the whether you've got a single drive axle or a single drive tandem axle group or a dual drive tandem axle group. And then there's a simple formula that can be applied to work out the... And just in case that looks a little bit confusing, random axle group, and there's a simple formula that can be applied to work out the... and just in case that looks a little bit confusing, it goes on. You can see there that TR means the number of tyre revolutions per kilometre stated by the manufacturer. R is the overall gear reduction between the towing vehicle and the engine. T means the towing vehicle's maximum engine torque. So, look, that's just one example of the detail which some of these regulatory regimes go into. There are plenty of other specific and technical provisions which can be found in other areas of regulatory activity, in particular things like waste, water management, and fisheries compliance. So all of this obviously adds a further dimension of complexity to the sentencing exercise in the local court. Local court magistrates generally will be much more familiar with offences under the Crimes Act or domestic violence or the Bail Act. So they will feel quite comfortable and well-equipped to readily deal with sentences under that legislation. So our challenge appearing in regulatory matters is to assist the magistrate to arrive at a sentence in a particular matter with the same sense of confidence. So just generally, the role of the prosecutor on sentence the local court, it was not that long ago that it was considered inappropriate for a prosecutor to make submissions on sentence in the local court. And I've actually been told from time to time that magistrate doesn't need to hear from me on that. However, I think that position has changed, and as a matter of procedural fairness, local courts will often invite submissions from the prosecutor. And I think that's particularly the case in a regulatory prosecution that involves unfamiliar legislation. So just some general comments to assist in understanding what goes on in the sentencing procedure. The High Court has made clear in the case of McCarrion that what's required is that the sentencer must take into account all relevant considerations, and importantly, there is no single correct sentence. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. You'll often see reference to the sentencing exercise being described as involving instinctive synthesis, which is something I've always found a little bit mysterious, but I think it does attempt to indicate that oftentimes magistrates in particular will have a general feel for matters in terms of sentence if they're familiar with them. One of the best comments, I think, comes from Veen number 2, which is another High Court case, that says that the sentencing process involves often guideposts that point in opposite directions, and I think that does aptly describe in some ways some of the competing tensions that come into play when a sentencing process is involved. So coming back to the point about legislation, one of the first important steps that we can take is to try to tailor our approach in the sentencing exercise to assist the magistrate in relation to each piece of legislation. And one of the useful tools for that is that oftentimes the legislation itself will contain objects. So, for instance, the Fishery Management Act states that the objects of the Act are to conserve, develop and share the fishery resources. And it goes on to more detail. But that's a useful starting point in terms of orientating the magistrate in the sentencing exercise and care services. National law sets out the objectives, in particular there subsection 2A, to ensure safety, health and the well-being of children attending education and care services. It goes on in quite a lot of detail as to what the intentions of the legislation are. The guiding principle that National Education Services Quality Framework, which is set up under the legislation, is that the rights and the best interests of the child are paramount. So little purple passages like that in the legislation are really gems from the point of view of drawing the magistrate's attention to the matters which the regulatory scheme is designed to address. And once again, going back to one of my favourites, the Heavy Vehicle National Law, that's really one of the most clear ones. Number A simply promotes public safety So if you're dealing with an offence under that regime that involves any sort of breach of safety, that's something that's specifically referred to. Having pointed to that general outline, I'll now call upon my colleague Cameron Gardner to go into a bit more detail about some of the aspects of sentencing which are important in this regime. Thanks.
Thanks, Brett. Now, I've got up on the screen there past, present and future, present, past and future. What do I mean by that? What I'm aiming to do at this point is to develop the idea of how does one approach the sentencing point is to develop the idea of how does one approach the sentencing experience, if I could call it that, and one has to remember that there are really as many different approaches to sentencing as there are sentencers, and perhaps even more approaches than that. But there's ultimately no determinative formula as to how to approach the sentencing exercise that's common or settled. What I am proposing as a way to perhaps conceptualise the idea of sentencing is to think of it as focused on three particular points in time. Now, the first of those points being the present, that is that a sentence ultimately revolves around a particular instance, a particular offence, a particular point in time or course of conduct. And so the sentencing court's first recourse is to an assessment of that objective seriousness. The sentencing exercise is also inherently backward-looking, that is to say it's taking into account or looking towards things that have led up to this event. That can be the past history of a defendant or their circumstances or their good character or whatever the case might be, as well as being forward-looking as well. That is to say, a sentence looks at or goes to things like general and specific deterrence and the prospects for rehabilitation. So there is, in amongst the sentencing exercise, these three points in time that are being encompassed, that is a backward-looking, a present-focused and a forward-looking focus. Now, the first of those considerations really is at the heart of how a prosecutor is assisting the court in a sentencing proceeding, that is, that being objective seriousness, because they are likely to be the types of offences that magistrates are not well familiar with, where their intuitive understanding is not going to be as well developed as more common offence types. So where do we start when we want to be telling a court about what makes a regulatory offence serious? As Brett's mentioned, recourse to the objects of an act or objects of a regulatory scheme is usually the best port of call. That is to say, or we ask ourselves the question, how readily linked is this offending conduct to those the objects of the act? So offences that go very much to the core of what a regulatory scheme is designed to stop are arguably more objectively serious than those that aren't. We might also look to the extent at which an offence provision is focused at ensuring regulatory compliance or ensuring the administration of an act is doing what it is meant to. So we might be arguably saying an offence is more serious because it cuts to the heart of the regulatory scheme doing its job as much as the objects of the act. Another thing to be aware of in relation to regulatory offences in particular is that commonly offences are framed in more complex and more convoluted terms than a regular run-of-the-mill Crimes Act type offence. So it's important for us to assist the court in being clear about what conduct in fact constitutes an offence how the offence is put together, and the court, in being clear about what conduct in fact constitutes an offence, how the offence is put together, and where the criminality lies in any given set of circumstances. An example of that would be in a childcare-related prosecution, and a matter I dealt with recently. A nominated supervisor of a childcare centre was charged in relation to a failure of supervision. In the particular circumstances of the case, that supervisor wasn't physically present when the particular child wasn't being supervised. And the question from the court in those circumstances is, well, this person wasn't there. Like, how does this all work? Is this less serious because they're not there? Is it more serious? And it's at times like that where one takes a step back and looks at the way an offence is structured and the way an offence is directing its attention. So in that example, the criminality lies in essentially a systemic failure. It doesn't rely on a person not being there to do something in particular at a given time, but rather the way in which a particular facility's systems are in place. Another aspect to be aware of in relation to sentencing in regulatory offences is limitation periods and the question of delay. Most regulatory regimes involved limitation periods that are much longer than the ones that the local court is most familiar with. The statutory standard period for summary offences in the Criminal Procedure Act is 6 months, but as you'll be aware, is the question of delay. So that is where it has taken some time for an offence to come to its resolution. The terminology that's used in the cases is a state of uncertain suspense that defendants are placed under, essentially not knowing what might happen between something being investigated and something actually reaching court. So in situations where there is a long limitation period, something to be aware of is the length of that period can draw into it this consideration at sentence that it's taken a long time to reach culmination. on a procedural point, the local court, as Brett mentioned, is a busy place and it likes to get through its work quickly. Of the many thousands of matters that are dealt with to sentence in the local court, most are dealt with on their first day of appearance. And indeed, as a general rule, at any point where a defendant is ready and willing to plead guilty, a court will be ready and willing to deal with the matter straight away. So something that is worth being aware of is that notwithstanding that a plea of guilty is yet to be entered, and perhaps even in circumstances where a plea of not guilty has been entered before, I always find it a good rule of thumb to be ready for a sentence because one can always be sprung on you. It's an unusual circumstance. It will occur on occasion, but it is a rare circumstance for a prosecutor to successfully seek an adjournment on sentence where there is a defendant ready to proceed. There certainly may be cases where a matter is of such volume and complexity that is warranted, but ordinarily the expectation from a prosecution perspective is that the court will expect one to be ready whenever a defendant is ready. Now, the statement of facts is really the core prosecution document on sentence, and it should be a document that encompasses all of the conduct that makes out the offence, and indeed it should be a document which encompasses all the matters or relevant matters that a prosecutor might want to make a submission on. I'm a firm believer that the most useful thing that I think I learned at the College of Law was the proof-making model, that is, one has evidence to prove facts and facts to make out elements or make submissions. So the statement of facts is what we need to base our submissions on. If it's not in our statement of facts, then we don't have something to base a submission on. So that's important at the stage of drafting a set of facts, but it's also, I think, important during the process of negotiating a plea, whereby there might be requests from the other side to amend a statement of facts. Something that needs to be kept in mind is the extent to which the prosecution's case on sentence is diminished by changes to facts. Obviously, defendants want things out of facts for good reason. So important aspects that a sentencing submission would be based on need to be, or careful consideration needs to be given around their editing. The final point I was going to draw attention to was about subjective cases. Prosecutors approach sentencing from a somewhat one-sided perspective. We know all about the objective circumstances. We all know how terrible someone's record is and how bad an offence is. But there will always be a positive case put on by the other side that we need to be aware will inevitably happen. We won't know what that is. But we can certainly expect it, and we can expect it to have a bearing on the sentence. A court will inevitably be required to take into account those aspects of the case, and the sentence will be determined from that. It's unusual. It would be unusual for a prosecutor to be too robust in objecting to what is put in relation to a subjective case. There's usually not a lot we can say about a defendant's background or their circumstances or those sorts of things. but I've found that the useful way in which to frame a submission around a subjective case is on a question of weight. That is to say, we can always put to the court that someone's subjective case might be relevant and it might be compelling, but it is never the only set of circumstances that's relevant to the question of sentence. There was a recent example of this, in fact, the case you might have read about in the media. It's the Crown and Amati of 2019. It was the situation where the transgender woman at the petrol station at Enmore attacked some people with an axe and was charged with attempted murder, I think it was. That was a sentence that went to the CCA on Crown Appeal. The sentence was effectively not quite doubled in terms of the non-parole period. And ultimately, what the Court of Criminal Appeal, the conclusion they reached there, was that the sentencing judge had taken into account a very compelling subjective case. And they certainly weren't critical of the subjective case or its relevance to sentencing, but the nub of their criticism of the sentence was that that was all that it focused on, and the sentence had failed to take into account the objective criminality and the other relevant factors. So ultimately it is always a balancing exercise where those aspects, where the subjective and the objective parts of sentence need to be properly balanced. And that doesn't necessarily mean we as prosecutors need to aggressively challenge subjective cases, but we do need to be aware of an appropriate submission about giving appropriate parts of the case the weight that they should. At that point, I'll pass the baton.
Thanks, Cameron. Okay, so you've beautifully prepared according to Cameron and Brett's sage advice, and then you come to the juicy question, what are they going to get? And there's really two questions that we commonly receive from clients in this regard. The first being, this is serious, can we get the maximum penalty? And the second being, this is serious, can we get this guy to go to jail? The first question is pretty succinctly dealt with. It's trite to say that maximum penalties are reserved for the worst cases. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that we need to use our imagination to conjure up the worst possible scenario we can think of. the High Court has made clear in the Crown and Chilick, or Kistner, what it means is that the court must determine whether an offence is so grave as to warrant the maximum penalty. In making that determination, we look at the objective features of the case, but we also look at the circumstances of the offender. So from our perspective, we do need to take a step back and say, OK, this is very serious, but does this compelling subjective case take us out of that worst category? Or has this person provided some assistance to the authorities, and would that take them out of that worst category? Also, we're here to talk about local court sentencing. So as a practical matter, you're rarely going to be dealing with maximum penalties in the local court. But it is worth remembering that although the local court jurisdictional maximum is 2 years, the court does still need to have regard to the maximum penalty set by Parliament as the relevant legislative guidepost. The court's not to substitute their jurisdictional limit as some kind of quasi-maximum penalty. And the authority for that is the Crown and Doan, D-O-A-N. The more common scenario that arises in our practice is whether a sentence of imprisonment is appropriate. And there are some misconceptions that float around about this. The first is that it's our role as prosecutors, where an offence is serious, to definitely be asking the court to impose the biggest sentence possible. The second, on the other end of the spectrum, is that as prosecutors we aren't allowed to say anything about what the sentence should be. Neither of those propositions are strictly true, and the situation is more nuanced than that. The starting point is Section 5 of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act, which says that a court must not sentence an offender to imprisonment unless it's satisfied that, having considered all possible alternatives, no penalty other than imprisonment is appropriate. There are specific provisions that apply when sentencing someone to 6 months or less. The court's requirement is appropriate. There are specific provisions that apply when sentencing someone to 6 months or less. The court's required to consider whether an intervention program, treatment or rehabilitation would be a suitable alternative that the court, and the court must give reasons if they decide not to do that. So that's recognising the fact that in many cases short fixed-term prison sentences may achieve less in terms of community safety and the community interest than other rehabilitative options. Once a court's determined that no penalty other than imprisonment is appropriate and determined the length of the term, the court must consider how the sentence of imprisonment should be served: full-time custody, intensive corrections order. When they're considering making an intensive corrections order, there are further considerations that apply. Community safety must be the paramount consideration. And when considering that, the court has to specifically consider whether the making of the ICO or sending the person to jail is better serving the interests of community safety. So you can see already that these provisions in the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act provide a framework, lots of different hooks where we as prosecutors can structure our submissions to assist the court. We can assist the court by submitting on whether there are appropriate alternatives to imprisonment, such as treatment or rehab. And we can assist the court by submitting on where the interests of community safety lie. In many cases, there'll clearly be alternatives to imprisonment available, and that should be acknowledged, and that really is the end of the question. But what about that serious case, that juicy case, where imprisonment does seem like a realistic option? What can we say about that? We're often met with the position from prosecutors that we're not allowed to go that one step further and make a submission that the sentence should be one of imprisonment. That perception arises from the two. But what did Barbara actually say? This was a case that there was really no doubt that Mr. Barbaro and Mr. Zarilli were going to jail. They had pleaded guilty to importing 15 million ecstasy tablets, cunningly disguised, as you can see, in tomato tins. At the time, it was the largest ever seizure of ecstasy in the world. I'm not sure if that's still the case. So you can imagine that Mr. B and Mr. Z were pretty worried about their fate. And sensibly, their lawyers met with the prosecutor before sentence, and it was agreed that if they entered a plea of guilty, the prosecutor would not submit that a sentence of life imprisonment was required or appropriate. This happened in a context where at the time it was commonplace and indeed expected of prosecutors in Victoria to make a submission as to the available sentencing range. And it's just worth bearing in mind that that's never actually been the position. tradition or the default approach in New South Wales. So you can imagine the dismay of poor Mr. B and Mr. Z when they get to their sentencing hearing and the judge says up front, "I'm not going to hear from you, Mr. Prosecutor, as to the available sentencing range. I don't want your submission on that issue. I'm not interested." Her Honour then sentenced Mr. B to life in prison and Mr. Z to a double-digit prison sentence. The offenders argued before the High Court that this was unfair. The plurality of the High Court said tough luck, but they also said a lot of interesting things about the role of the prosecutor. They said that the prosecution's statement of what the available sentence range is a statement of opinion. It's essentially irrelevant. It does not contain any proposition of fact or law which the sentencing judge can properly take into account. The prosecution is not required and should not be permitted to make such a statement as to the bounds to the sentence the sentencing judge can properly take into account. The prosecution is not required and should not be permitted to make such a statement as to the bounds to the sentencing judge. Even the term available range is misleading. What does that mean? Surely the available range is determined by Parliament when the maximum penalty is set. The exercise of the sentencing discretion does not require the court to determine the bounds of the range in which a sentence should fall and essentially drop a pin within that range. The practice of the prosecutor in submitting as to the available sentencing range requires the prosecutor to act as a surrogate judge. This is not their role. The High Court emphasised that prosecutors often express views that, while proper, are not dispassionate. We like to think that we're acting entirely objectively and dispassionately on behalf of the community, but that's not always the case. They gave two examples. Where you have an offender that's provided assistance to the authorities, the prosecutor may see it as advancing the public interest to ensure that such assistance is suitably and publicly rewarded. In doing so, they're encouraging other offenders to take up the opportunity to provide assistance and get the benefit of doing so. Another example, where a plea is avoided a lengthy and complex trial, the prosecutor may be well aware of the ordeal that's just been skipped by this plea and may place great emphasis on the utilitarian value of the plea. These factors are likely to influence the view the prosecutor takes of the appropriate sentencing range, and it's the role of the judge to ensure such matters are not given undue weight. High Court also had something to say about the use of statistics and comparable cases is consistency, and the consistency that's sought is the application of relevant legal principles, not numerical equivalence. Prior cases may well establish a range of sentences which have been imposed, but that history doesn't establish the bounds in which the sentencing court is permitted to operate. The history stands as a yardstick against which to examine a proposed sentence. What's important is the unifying principles which those sentences both reveal and reflect. So when we're thinking about our role as prosecutors, we should be mindful that in order to meaningfully assist the court, we have to present that information about comparable cases in a way which enables those principles to be identified. I'll leave you with one final quote from Barbara, which I think neatly sums up how we as prosecutors can think about our task. There's the unfortunate Mr. Barbara there. The court said, "If a sentencing judge is properly informed about the party's submissions about what facts should be found, the relevant sentencing principles, and comparable sentences, the judge will have all the information which is necessary to decide what sentence should be passed without the need for the prosecution to proffer its view about available range." So that really encapsulates a handy little checklist about how we can think about how we're structuring our case to give the court all the information it needs and to perform our role as prosecutors of assisting the court not to fall into appellable error. The Victorian Court of Appeal since Barbaro has made some decisions which clarify what the Crown can and can't say about sentences of imprisonment. And they've made it clear that Barbaro doesn't mean that a prosecutor can't submit this is a case in which a sentence of imprisonment is appropriate. Also in Queensland, there's been, we haven't had any express clarification on that point in New South Wales, but it's my view that the position is the same here. And Barbaro doesn't stand for the proposition that we're not able to make any submission about what would be an appropriate sentencing type. Submitting that a sentence of imprisonment is appropriate in all the circumstances is not the same thing as saying this guy should get 2 to 6 years. Let's think of an example. If you're submitting that an offence is objectively serious, that the offender has a prior history of similar offending and specific deterrence is important, you're saying that he's been given the benefit of a bond before and did not use that opportunity to engage in rehabilitation. You're saying there's no evidence before the court to suggest the offender will undertake treatment if given the benefit of a community-based sentence. And you've presented the court with cases and with similar objective and subjective features in which imprisonment has been imposed. The corollary of all of that is that sentence of imprisonment is appropriate in your submission. We should say so. It doesn't assist the court to simply throw up a bunch of material and leave the court to work out what it all means. Just a side note on comparable cases and statistics, because we are talking about the local court. The High Court has said a lot about statistics as being a blunt instrument and of limited utility, and those kind of bar graphs that you see on the JERS website have attracted particular ire. But the reality is, magistrates sometimes kind of like them. They particularly like them if, as Brett pointed out, you're dealing with an offence that they don't know much about. You're asking them to sentence for something to do with fish or water or childcare centres or electoral offending, and they have absolutely no idea where to start. There's nothing quite like a nice, but the reality is, magistrates sometimes kind of like them. They particularly like them if, as Brett pointed out, you're dealing with an offence that they don't know much about. You're asking them to sentence for something to do with fish or water or childcare centres or electoral offending, and they have absolutely no idea where to start. There's nothing quite like a nice bar graph to help a magistrate get the lay of the land. So by all means, bring them along. Do it with appropriate contrition. Be ready to talk about their limited utility, but also be ready to address the court on what the statistics mean. It helps the magistrate a lot more if you understand the sample size, you understand the period of time over which those statistics were collected. It assists the court even more if you come armed with some kind of table or summary of the facts and circumstances of similar cases. If we're dealing with regulatory prosecutions in the local court, there may be no published decisions on that particular area of law, and the only body which actually has access to information about what's happened in other cases may be the regulatory authority. So we may be the only people in the position to put that information before the court, and if we can do so, we should do so. When you're summarising the cases, of course, it should be done fairly, with emphasis on factors which both assist the prosecution and assist the defendant. I'll hand back to Brett.
Thanks, Sophie and Cameron. As you can see, it's an area that involves some complexity and probably something that can't be covered in depth in the time we have available. So we're already running a little bit over time. I'll just shoot quickly to the end just as a bit of a takeaway. So as agencies, investigators, client agencies, a bit of a checklist there, things to think about. Something of the objects of the scheme. Do you have any evidence that supports the harm or the damage that you're asserting or the potential harm or damage? If there's a statement from someone within the agency that can explain the policy behind the scheme, that's often of very great assistance. As Cameron's pointed out, a clear, useful, comprehensive statement of facts. Obviously, the antecedents of the offender, but particularly in the regulatory context, if there's been repeat offences of a like type, that does tend to bite a lot in the local court. As Sophie's just helpfully summarised, the table of comparable cases, if you're able to put one together, and something we don't have time to deal with today, but just a note that professional costs can be sought in regulatory prosecutions, and again, it's something that magistrates aren't always familiar with. So some preparation on that is probably a topic for another day. So thank you very much, and I'll hand you back.